You're pure as the driven snow. The mention of trust, before need, before love, came trust, the thing she valued most. And he, Coriolanus Snow, was the one she trusted. As the audience applauded, he stood still, clutching his box, too moved even to join in. The rest of the covey ran on stage, while Lucy Gray disappeared behind the blanket. Maud Ivory got her crate back in place, and a twangy tune began. Well, there's a dark and a troubled side of life. There's a bright and a sunny side, too. Coriolanus recognized the tune, the song about the sunny side, the one she'd been singing during the murders. This was his chance. He maneuvered his way out the nearby door as inconspicuously as possible. With everyone safely inside, he sprinted around the gymnasium to the locker room and tapped on the outside door. It flew open immediately, as if she'd been waiting for him, and Lucy Gray flung herself into his arms. For a while, they just stood there, clinging to each other, but time was precious. "I'm so sorry about Sejanus. Are you okay?" she asked breathlessly. Of course, she knew nothing about his role in that. "Not really, but I'm still here for the moment." She drew back to look at his face. "What happened? How did they find out about him helping to get Lil out?"
"I don't know. Someone betrayed him, I guess," he said. Lucy Gray didn't hesitate.
"Spruce."
"Probably." Coriolanus touched her cheek. "What about you? Are you all right?"
"I'm awful. It's been just awful. Watching him die like that, and then everything after that night. I know you killed Mayfair to protect me. Me and the rest of the covey."
She rested her forehead on his chest.
"I'll never be able to thank you for that."
He stroked her hair. "Well, she's gone for good now. You're safe."
"Not really. Not really."
Distraught, Lucy Gray twisted away and began to pace.
"The mayor, he won't leave me alone. He's sure I killed her, killed them both. He drives that awful car down to our house and sits in front of it for hours. The peacekeepers, they've questioned us all 3 times now. Anyway, they say he's on them night and day to arrest me. And if they don't make me pay, he will."
That was scary. What did they say to do?
"Avoid him." "But how can I, when he's sitting 10 feet from my house?" she cried. "Mayfair was all that mattered to him. I don't think he'll rest until I'm dead. Now he's starting to threaten the rest of the covey. I'm going to run away."
"What?" asked Coriolanus. "Where?"
"North, I guess. Like Billy Tope and the others talked about. If I stay here, I know he'll find a way to kill me. I've been setting some supplies by. Out there, I might survive."
Lucy Gray rushed back into his arms.
"I'm glad I got to tell you goodbye."
Run away. She was really going to do it. Head into the wilderness and take her chances. He knew only the prospect of certain death could drive her to do such a thing. For the first time in days, he saw a way to escape the noose. "Not goodbye. I'm going with you."
"You can't. I won't let you. You'd be risking your life," she warned him.
Coriolanus laughed. "My life? My life consists of wondering how long it will be until they find those guns and connect me to Mayfair's murder. They're searching the seam now. It could be any moment. We'll go together." Her brow creased with disbelief.
"Do you mean it?"
"We go tomorrow," he said. "One step ahead of the executioner."
"And the mayor," she added. "We'll finally be free of him, of District 12, of the Capitol, all of it, tomorrow, at dawn."
"Tomorrow at dawn," he confirmed. He thrust the box into her hands. "From Pluribus. Accept the scarf, that's from me. I better run before someone realizes I'm gone and gets suspicious." He pulled her in for a passionate kiss. "It's just us again."
"Just us," she said,
her face shining with joy. Coriolanus flew out of the locker room with wings on his heels.
"Let us greet with a song of hope each day, though the moments be cloudy or fair."
He was not just going to live, he was going to live with her, as they had that day at the lake. He thought of the taste of the fresh fish, the sweet air, and the freedom to act however he wanted, as nature had intended, to answer to no one, to truly be rid of the world's oppressive expectations forever.
"Let us trust in tomorrow always, to keep us, one and all, in its care."
He made it back to the gymnasium and slipped into his place in time to join in the last chorus.
"Keep on the sunny side, always the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way if we keep on the sunny side of life. Yes, sir, keep on the sunny side of life."
Coriolanus's mind was in a whirl. Lucy Gray rejoined the covey for one of those harmonious things with unintelligible words, and he tuned them out as he tried to ride the curve life had just thrown him. He and Lucy Gray, running away into the wilderness. Madness. But then again, why not? It was the only lifeline in his reach, and he meant to grasp it and hold on tightly. Tomorrow was Sunday, so he had the day off. He'd leave as early as possible, grab breakfast, possibly his last meal in civilization when the mess opened at 6, then hit the road. His bunkmates would be sleeping off the whiskey. He would have to sneak off the base. The fence. He hoped Spruce had had good information about the weak spot behind the generator. And then he'd make his way to Lucy Gray and run as fast and as far as he could. But wait, should he go to her house? With the covey all there? And possibly the mayor? Or did she mean to meet in the meadow? He was mulling it over when the number ended and she slid back up on her stool with her guitar.
"I almost forgot. I promised to sing this for one of you," she said.
And there it was again, ever so casually, her hand on her pocket. She began the song she'd been working on when he'd come up behind her in the meadow.
Are you coming to the tree where they strung up a man they say murdered 3? Strange things did happen here. No stranger would it be if we met up at midnight in the hanging tree.
The hanging tree, her old meeting spot with Billy Tope. That's where she wanted him to meet her.
Are you coming to the tree where the dead man called out for his love to flee? Strange things did happen here. No stranger would it be if we met up at midnight in the hanging tree.
He would have preferred not to meet up at her old lover's rendezvous spot, but it was certainly much safer than meeting at her house. Who would be there on a Sunday morning? Anyway, Billy Tope was no longer a concern. She took another breath. She must have written more.
Are you coming to the tree where I told you to run so we'd both be free? Strange things did happen here. No stranger would it be if we met up at midnight in the hanging tree.
Who did she mean? Billy Tope telling her to come there so they'd be free? Her telling him tonight that they'd be free?
Are you coming to the tree? Wear a necklace of rope, side by side with me. Strange things did happen here. No stranger would it be if we met up at midnight in the hanging tree.
Now he got it. The song, the speaker in the song, was Billy Tope, and he was singing it to Lucy Gray. He'd witnessed Arlo's death, heard the birds call out his last words, begged Lucy Gray to run away to freedom with him, and when she'd rejected him, he'd wanted her to hang with him rather than get to live without him. Coriolanus hoped this was the final Billy Tope song. What else could be said, really? Not that it mattered. This might be his song, but she was singing it to Coriolanus. Snow lands on top. The covey performed a few more numbers. Then Lucy Gray said,
"Well, as my daddy used to say, you have to go to bed with the birds if you want to greet them at dawn. Thanks for having us tonight, and how about one more round of wishes for Commander Hoff?"
The whole drunken gymnasium slurred out one more happy birthday chorus for the commander. The covey took their final bow and exited the stage. Coriolanus waited in the back to help Bug get Beanpole back to the barrack. Before they knew it, it was lights out and they had to climb into bed in the dark. His bunkmates lost consciousness almost immediately, but he lay awake, going over the escape plan in his head. It didn't require much, just him, the clothes on his back, a couple of mementos in his pocket, and a lot of luck. Coriolanus rose at dawn, dressed in fresh fatigues, and tucked a couple of clean changes of underclothes and socks into his pockets. He chose three photos of his family, the circle of his mother's powder, and his father's compass, and hid them among his clothes as well. Last, he made the most convincing form of himself he could with his pillow and blanket and arranged the sheet over it. As his bunkmates snored on, he gave the room one final look and wondered if he would miss them. He joined a handful of early risers for a breakfast of bread pudding, which seemed a positive omen for the trip, as it was Lucy Gray's favorite. He wished he could take her some, but his pockets were full to bursting, and they didn't have napkins in the mess. Draining his cup of apple juice, he wiped his mouth on the back of his hand, dropped off his tray for the dishwashers, and headed outside, planning to make a beeline for the generator. As he stepped into the sunlight, a pair of guards descended on him. Armed guards, not aides. "Private Snow," said one. "You're wanted in the commander's office." A jolt of adrenaline shot through him. His blood pounded in his temples. This couldn't be happening. They couldn't be coming to arrest him just when he was on the verge of freedom, of a new life with Lucy Gray. His eyes darted to the generator about 100 yards from the mess hall. Even with his recent training, he'd never make it. He never would. "I just need 5 more minutes," he pleaded with the universe. "Even 2 will do." The universe ignored him. Flanked by the guards, he drew back his shoulders and marched straight to the commander's office, prepared to face his doom. As he entered, Commander Hoff rose from his desk, snapped to attention, and gave him a salute. "Private Snow," he said, "let me be the first to congratulate you. You leave for officer school tomorrow." Chapter 30. Coriolanus stood stunned as the guard slapped him on the back, laughing.
I...
"You're the youngest person ever to pass the test," the commander beamed. "Ordinarily, we'd train you here, but your scores recommend you for an elite program in District 2. We'll be sorry to see you go." Oh, how he wished he could go to District 2, which was not really that far from his home in the capital. To officer school, elite officer school, where he could distinguish himself and find a way back to a life worth living. This might be an even better road to power than the university had offered. But there was still a murder weapon with his name on it out there. His DNA would condemn him, just as it had on the handkerchief. Sadly, tragically, it was too dangerous to stay. It hurt to play along. "What time do I leave?" he asked. "There's a hovercraft headed that way early tomorrow morning, and you'll be on it. You're off today, I think. Use the time to pack up and say your goodbyes." The commander shook his hand for the second time in 2 days. "We expect great things from you." Coriolanus thanked the commander and headed outside, where he stood a moment weighing his options. It was no use. There were no options. Hating himself and hating Sejanus Plinth even more, he walked toward the building that housed the generator, almost not caring if he was apprehended. What a bitter disappointment, to have a second chance at a bright future so irrevocably stripped away. He had to remind himself of the rope and the gallows, and the jabberjays mimicking his last words to renew his focus. He was about to desert the peacekeepers. He needed to snap out of it. When he reached the building, he took a quick look over his shoulder. But the base still slept, and he slunk around to the back without witnesses. He examined the fence and could find no opening at first. He wound his fingers in the links and gave them a shake of frustration. Sure enough, The mesh pulled free of a supporting pole, leaving a break in the fence he could just squeeze through. Outside, his natural wariness reinstated itself. He skirted around the rear of the base and through a wooded area, eventually making his way to the road that led to the hanging tree. Once there, he simply followed the path the truck had taken on previous trips, walking briskly, but not so fast as to attract attention. There was precious little to attract anyway on a hot Sunday shortly after dawn. Most miners and peacekeepers would not rise for hours. After a few miles, he reached the depressing field and broke into a run for the hanging tree, eager to conceal himself in the woods. There was no sign of Lucy Gray, and as he passed under the branches, he wondered if in fact he'd misinterpreted her message and should have headed to the seam instead. Then he caught a glimpse of Orange and tracked it to a clearing. There she stood, unloading a stack of bundles from a small wagon, his scarf wound in a fetching manner around her head. She ran over and hugged him, and he responded even though it felt too hot for an embrace. The kiss that followed put him in a better mood. His hand went to the orange scarf in her hair. "This seems very bright for fugitives." Lucy Gray smiled. "Well, I don't want you to lose me. You still up for this?"
"I have no choice."
Realizing that sounded half-hearted, he added, "You're all that matters to me now."
"You too. You're my life now. Sitting here waiting for you to show up, I realized I'd never really be brave enough to do this without you," she admitted. "It's not just how hard it will be. It's too lonely. I might have made it for a few days, but then I'd have come home to the covey."
"I know. I didn't even consider running until you brought it up. It's so daunting." He ran a hand over her bundles. "I'm sorry, I couldn't risk bringing anything much."
"I didn't think you could. I've been collecting all this, and I raided our storeroom, too. It's okay. I left the covey the rest of the money."
As if convincing herself, she said,
"They'll be okay."
She hoisted up a pack and threw it over her shoulder. He gathered some of the supplies.
"What will they do? I mean the band, without you."
"Oh, they'll get by. They can all carry a tune. And Maud Ivory's just a few years from replacing me as lead singer anyway," said Lucy Gray. "Besides, the way trouble seems to find me, I may be wearing out my welcome in District 12. Last night the commander told me not to sing The Hanging Tree anymore. Too dark, he said. Too rebellious, more like it. I promised he'd never hear it from my lips again."
"It's a strange song," offered Coriolanus.
Lucy Gray laughed.
"Well, Maud Ivory likes it. She says it has real authority."
"Like my voice, when I sang the anthem in the Capitol," Coriolanus remembered.
"That's it," said Lucy Gray. "You ready?"
They divided everything between them. It took him a moment to realize what was missing.
"Your guitar, you're not taking it?"
"I'm leaving it for Maud Ivory. That and my mama's dresses."
She struggled to make light of it.
"What will I need them for? Tam Amber thinks there's still people in the north, but I'm not convinced. I think it's just going to be us."
For a moment, he realized that he wasn't the only one leaving his dreams behind. "We'll get new dreams out there," Coriolanus promised, with more conviction than he felt. He pulled out his father's compass, consulted it, and pointed. "North is this way."
"I thought we'd head to the lake first. It's mostly north. I'd kind of like to see it one more time," she said.
It seemed as good a plan as any, so he didn't object. Soon they'd just be adrift in the wilderness, never to return. Why not indulge her? He tucked in a bit of scarf that had come loose. "The lake it is." Lucy Gray gazed back at the town, although the only thing Coriolanus could make out was the gallows.
"Goodbye, District 12. Goodbye, Hanging Tree, and Hunger Games, and Mayor Lip. Someday something will kill me, but it won't be you."
She turned and headed deeper into the woods.
"Not much to miss," agreed Coriolanus.
"I'll miss the music and my pretty birds," said Lucy Gray with a catch in her voice. "I'm hoping one day they can follow me, though."
"You know what I won't miss? People.
Coriolanus replied. Except for a handful. They're mostly awful, if you think about it.
People aren't so bad, really, she said. It's what the world does to them. Like us in the arena. We did things in there we'd never have considered if they'd just left us alone.
I don't know. I killed Mayfair and there was no arena in sight, he said.
But only to save me.
She thought it over.
I think there's a natural goodness built into human beings. You know when you've stepped across the line into evil, and it's your life's challenge to try and stay on the right side of that line.
Sometimes there are tough decisions. He'd been making them all summer.
I know that. Of course I do. I'm a victor,
she said ruefully.
It'd be nice in my new life not to have to kill anyone else.
I'm with you there. Three seems enough for one lifetime, and certainly enough for one summer. A feral cry came from nearby, reminding him of his lack of a weapon. I'm going to make a walking stick. Do you want one? She pulled up.
Sure. That could come in handy in more ways than one.
They found a couple of stout branches, and she steadied them while he snapped off their limbs.
Who's the third?
What? She was giving him a funny look. His hand slipped, driving a piece of bark under his nail. Ow! She ignored his injury.
Person you killed. You said you killed three people this summer.
Coriolanus bit at the end of the splinter to pull it out with his teeth, buying a moment of time. Who indeed? The answer was Sejanus, of course, but he couldn't admit to that. Can you get this out? He held out his hand, wiggling the compromised fingernail, hoping to distract her.
Let me see.
She examined his splinter.
So, Bobbin, Mayfair, who's the third?
His mind raced for a plausible explanation. Could he have been involved in a freak accident? A training death? He was cleaning a weapon and it went off by mistake? He decided it was best to make a joke of it. Myself. I killed the old me so I could come with you. She plucked the splinter free.
There. Well, I hope old you doesn't haunt new you. We've already got enough ghosts between us.
The moment passed, but it had killed the conversation. Neither of them spoke again until the halfway point, where they stopped for a breather. Lucy Gray unscrewed the plastic jug and offered it to him.
Will they miss you yet?
Probably not until dinner. You? He took a deep drink of water.
Only one up when I left was Tam Amber. I told him I was going to find out about a goat. We've been talking about building a herd, sell the milk as a sideline, she said. I've probably got a few more hours before they start looking. Might be night before they think about the hanging tree and find the wagon. They'll put it together.
He handed her the jug. Will they try to follow you?
Maybe. But we'll be too far gone.
She took a swig and wiped her mouth with the back of her hand.
Will they hunt you?
He doubted the peacekeepers would be concerned any time soon. Why would he desert with elite officers' school waiting? If anyone even noticed he was missing, they'd probably think he'd gone into town with another peacekeeper. Unless they found the gun, of course. He didn't want to go into all the school stuff now while the wound was still fresh. I don't know. Even when they realize I've run, they won't know where to look. They hiked on toward the lake, each lost in their own thoughts. It all seemed unreal to him, as if this were just a pleasure outing, as the one 2 Sundays ago had been, as if they were going for a picnic and he must be sure to get back in time for fried bologna and curfew. But no. When they reached the lake, they'd move on into the wilderness, to a life consumed with the most basic type of survival. How would they eat? Where would they live? And what on earth would they do with themselves when the challenges of obtaining food and shelter had been met? Her with no music. Him with no school or military or anything. Have a family? It seemed too bleak an existence to condemn a child to. Any child, let alone one of his own. What was there to aspire to once wealth, fame, and power had been eliminated? Was the goal of survival further survival and nothing more? Preoccupied as he was with these questions, The second leg of the journey to the lake passed quickly. They set down their loads on the shore, and Lucy Gray went directly to find branches for fishing poles.
"We don't know what lies ahead, so we better fill up here," she said.
She showed him how to attach the heavy thread and hooks to their poles. Clawing through the soft mud for worms disgusted him, and he wondered if this would be a daily activity. It would, if they were hungry enough. They baited the hooks and sat silently on the bank, waiting for a strike as the birds chattered around them. She caught two. He caught nothing. Heavy dark clouds rolled in, providing some relief from the beating sun, but adding to his oppression. This was his life now. Digging for worms and being at the mercy of the weather. Elemental. Like an animal. He knew this would be easier if he wasn't such an exceptional person. The best and the brightest humanity had to offer. The youngest to pass the officer candidate test. If he'd been useless and stupid, the loss of civilization would not have hollowed out his insides in this manner. He'd have taken it in stride. Thick, cold raindrops began to plop down on him, leaving wet marks on his fatigues.
"Never be able to cook in this," Lucy Gray said. "Better go inside. There's a fireplace in there we can use."
She could only mean the one lake house that still had a roof. Probably his last roof, until he built one himself. How did you build a roof, anyway? It had not been a question on the officer candidate test. After she'd quickly cleaned the fish and wrapped them in leaves, they gathered up their bundles and hurried to the house as the rain pelted them. It might have been fun if it hadn't been his real life. Just an adventure for a few hours with a charming girl and a fulfilling future elsewhere. The door was jammed, but Lucy Gray bumped it with her hip and it swung open. They scrambled in out of the wet and dropped their belongings. It was only one room with concrete walls, ceiling, and floor. There was no sign of electricity, but light came through the windows on four sides and the single door. His eyes lit on the fireplace, full of old ashes, with a neat pile of dried wood stacked beside it. At least they wouldn't have to forage for that. Lucy Gray crossed to the fireplace, laid the fish down on the little concrete hearth, and began to arrange layers of wood and twigs on an old metal grate.
"We keep some wood in here, so there's always some dry."
Coriolanus considered the possibility of just staying in the sturdy little house, with plenty of wood around and the lake to fish in. But no, it would be too dangerous to put down roots this close to District 12. If the Covey knew of this spot, surely other people did too. He had to deny himself even this last shred of protection. Would he end up in a cave after all? He thought of the beautiful snow penthouse, with its marble floors and crystal chandeliers. His home, his rightful home. The wind blew a splatter of rain in, peppering his pants with icy drops. He swung the door shut behind him and froze. The door had concealed something. A long burlap bag. From the opening poked the barrel of a shotgun. It couldn't be. Unable to breathe, he nudged the bag open with his boot, revealing the shotgun and a peacekeeper's rifle. A little more, and he could recognize the grenade launcher. Beyond question, these were the black market guns Sejanus had bought in the shed, and among them the murder weapons. Lucy Gray lit the fire.
"I brought along an old metal can, thinking maybe we could carry live coals from place to place. I don't have many matches, and it's hard to get a fire going from flint."
"Uh-huh," said Coriolanus. "Good idea." How had the weapons gotten here? It made sense, really. Billy Tope could have brought spruce to the lake. Or maybe Spruce had simply known about it anyway. It would have been useful to the rebels during the war to have as a hideout. And Spruce had been smart enough to know he couldn't risk hiding the evidence in District 12.
"Hey, what'd you find there?"
Lucy Gray joined him and leaned down, pulling the burlap from the weapons.
"Oh, are these the ones they had in the shed?"
"I think they must be," he said. "Should we take the guns along?" Lucy Gray drew back, rose to her feet, and considered them for a long moment.
"Rather not. I don't trust them. This will come in handy, though."
She pulled out a long knife, turning the blade over in her hand.
"I think I'll go dig up some catnip. since we got the fire going anyway. There's a good patch by the lake.
I thought they weren't ready, he said.
2 weeks can make a lot of difference, she said.
It's still raining, he objected. You'll get soaked. She laughed.
Well, I'm not made of sugar.
In truth, he was happy for a minute alone to think. After she left, he lifted the bottom of the burlap bag and the weapon slid out onto the floor. Kneeling beside the pile, he picked up the peacekeeper's rifle he'd killed Mayfair with and cradled it in his arms. Here it was, the murder weapon. Not in a capital forensic lab, but here, in his hands, in the middle of the wilderness, where it posed no threat at all. All he had to do was destroy it, and he would be free from the hangman's noose, free to go back to the base, free to go forward to District 2, free to rejoin the human race without fear. Tears of relief flooded his eyes, and he began to laugh out of sheer joy. How would he do it? Burn it in a bonfire? Disassemble it and scatter the parts to the four winds? Throw it into the lake? Once the gun was gone, there'd be nothing to connect him to the murders. Absolutely nothing.
No, wait. There would be one thing. Lucy Gray. Well, no matter. She would never tell.
She wouldn't be thrilled, obviously, when he told her there'd been a change of plans, that he was returning to the peacekeepers and heading to District 2 tomorrow at dawn, essentially leaving her to her fate. Still, she'd never rat him out. It wasn't her style, and it would implicate her in the murders as well. It would mean she could wind up dead, and as the Hunger Games had shown, Lucy Gray possessed an extraordinary talent for self-preservation. Plus, she loved him. She'd said so last night in the song. Even more, she trusted him. Although if he ditched her in the woods to claw out an existence alone, no doubt she would consider that a breach of faith. He had to think of just the right way to break the news. But what would that be? I love you deeply, but I love officer school more? That wasn't going to go over well. And he did love her. He did. It was just that, only a few hours into his new life in the wilderness, he knew he hated it. The heat, and the worms, and those birds yakking nonstop. She was clearly taking a long time with those potatoes. Coriolanus glanced out the window. The rain had diminished to a sprinkle. She hadn't wanted to go by herself. Too lonely. Her song said that she needed, loved, and trusted him. But would she forgive him, even if he deserted her? Billy Tope had crossed her, and he'd ended up dead. He could hear him now.
Makes me sick, how you're playing the kids. Poor Lucy Gray, poor Lamb.
And see her sinking her teeth into his hand. He thought about how coolly she'd killed in the arena. First that frail little Wovey. That was a cold-blooded move if he'd ever seen one. Then the calculated way she'd taken out Treach, baiting him to attack her, really, so she could whip that snake out of her pocket. And she claimed that Reaper had rabies, that it was a mercy kill, but who knew? No, Lucy Gray was no lamb. She was not made of sugar. She was a victor. He checked to see that the peacekeeper's rifle was loaded, then opened the door wide. She was nowhere in sight. He walked down to the lake, trying to remember where Clerk Carmine had been digging before he brought them the Katniss plant. It didn't matter. The swampy area around the lake was deserted, and the bank undisturbed. Lucy Gray? The only response came from a lone mockingjay on a nearby branch, who made an effort to mimic his voice but failed, as his words were not particularly musical. Give it up, he muttered to the thing. You're no jabberjay. No question she was hiding from him, but why? There could only be one answer. Because she'd figured it out, all of it. That destroying the guns would wash away all physical evidence of his connection to the murders. That he no longer wanted to run away. That she was the last witness to tie him to the crime. But they'd always had each other's backs, so why would she suddenly think he might harm her? Why, when only yesterday he'd been pure as the driven snow? Sejanus. She must have figured out that Sejanus was the third person Coriolanus had killed. She wouldn't have to know anything about the stunt with the Jabberjays, only that he'd been Sejanus's confidant, and that Sejanus was a rebel while Coriolanus was a defender of the capital. Still, to think he'd kill her? He looked down at the loaded gun in his hands. Maybe he should have left it in the shed. It looked bad coming after her, armed, as if he was hunting her. But he wasn't really going to kill her. Just talk to her and make sure she saw sense. Put down the gun, he told himself. But his hands refused to cooperate. All she has is a knife. A big knife. The best he could manage was to sling the gun onto his back. Lucy Gray? Are you okay? You're scaring me. Where are you? All she'd have to say was, I understand. I'll go on alone, like I was planning to all along. But just this morning she'd admitted she didn't think she could make it on her own, that she'd return to the covey after a few days. She knew he wouldn't believe her. Lucy Gray, please, I just want to talk to you, he shouted. What was her plan here? To hide until he grew tired and went back to the base? And then sneak back home tonight? That didn't work for him. Even with the murder weapon gone, she'd still be dangerous. What if she went back to District 12 now and the mayor succeeded in getting her arrested? What if they interrogated or even tortured her? The story would come out. She hadn't killed anyone. He had. His word against hers. Even if they didn't believe her, his reputation would be destroyed. Their romance would be revealed, along with the details of how he'd cheated in the Hunger Games. Dean Highbottom might be brought in as a character witness. He couldn't risk it. Still no sign of her. She was giving him no choice but to hunt her down in the woods. The rain had stopped now, leaving the air humid and the earth muddy. He went back to the house and scanned the ground until he found the slight imprint of her shoes, then followed her tracks until he reached the brush where the woods began again in earnest, and quietly made his way into the dripping trees. Bird chatter filled his ears, and the overcast sky made visibility poor. The underbrush concealed her footprints, but somehow he felt he was on the right track. Adrenaline sharpened his senses, and he noticed a snapped branch here, a scuff mark in the moss there. He felt a bit guilty, frightening her this way. What was she doing? Quivering in the bushes while she tried to suppress her sobs? The idea of life without him must be breaking her heart. A patch of orange caught his eye, and he smiled. I don't want you to lose me, she'd said. And he hadn't. He pushed through the branches and into a small clearing canopied by trees. The orange scarf lay across some briars, where it had apparently blown loose and snagged as she fled. Oh well. It confirmed he was on the right track. He went to retrieve it. Maybe he'd keep it after all. When a faint rustle in the leaves pulled him up short, he just registered the snake when it struck, uncoiling like a spring and digging its teeth into the forearm extended toward the scarf. Ah! He screamed in pain. It released him immediately and slithered into the brush before he even had a chance to get a good look at it. Panic set in as he stared at the red, arched bite mark on his forearm. Panic and disbelief. Lucy Gray had tried to kill him. This was no coincidence. The trailing scarf, the poised snake. Maud Ivory had said she always knew where to find them. This was a booby trap, and he'd walked straight into it. Poor lamb, indeed. He was beginning to sympathize with Billy Taupe. Coriolanus knew nothing about snakes other than the rainbow ones in the arena. Feet rooted to the ground, heart racing, he expected to die on the spot. But while the wound hurt, he was still standing. He didn't know how long he might have, but by all things snow, she was going to pay for this. Should he tie off the arm with the tourniquet? Suck out the venom? They hadn't done survival training yet. Afraid his first aid treatments might only spread the poison more swiftly through his system, he yanked his sleeve down over his forearm, pulled his rifle off his shoulder, and started after her. If he'd felt better, He'd have laughed at the irony of how quickly their relationship had deteriorated into their own private Hunger Games. She wasn't so easy to track now, and he realized the earlier clues had been left to lead him directly to the snake. But she couldn't be that far away. She'd want to know if the thing killed him, or if she should form another plan of attack. Maybe she hoped he'd pass out so she could cut his throat with the long knife. Trying to quiet his panting, he moved deeper into the woods, gently pushing the branches back with the nose of his rifle. But it was impossible to discern her whereabouts. Think, he told himself. Where would she go? The answer hit him like a ton of bricks. She would not want to battle him, armed with a rifle, when she had only a knife. She'd return to the lake house to get a gun herself. Perhaps she'd circled around him and was headed there right now. He strained his ears and yes, yes. He thought he could hear someone moving off to his right, retreating to the lake. He started running toward the sound and then stopped abruptly. Sure enough, having heard him, she was flying through the underbrush, realizing what he had realized, no longer caring if he heard her. He estimated her to be about 10 yards away, lifted the rifle to his shoulder, and released a spray of bullets in her direction. A flock of birds squawked as they took to the air, and he heard a faint cry. Got you, he thought. He crashed through the woods after her, branches and thorns catching his clothes and scratching his face, ignoring all of it until he came to the spot where he'd guessed her to be. There was no trace of her. No matter. She would have to move again. And when she moved, he'd find her. Lucy Gray, he said in his normal voice. Lucy Gray, it's not too late to work something out. Of course it was, but he owed her nothing. Certainly not the truth. Lucy Gray, won't you talk to me? Her voice surprised him, lifting suddenly and sweetly into the air.
Are you? Are you? Coming to the tree? Wear a necklace of rope, side by side with me. Strange things did happen here. No stranger would it be if we met up at midnight in the hanging tree.
Yes, I get it, he thought. You know about Sejanus. Necklace of rope and all that. He took a step in her direction, just as a mockingjay picked up her song. Then a second. Then a third. The woods came alive with their melody as dozens joined in. He dove through the trees and then opened fire on the spot the voice had come from. Had he hit her? He couldn't tell because the birdsong filled his ears, disorienting him. Little black specks swam in his field of vision, and his arm began to throb. Lucy Gray! He bellowed in frustration. Clever, devious, deadly girl. She knew they'd cover for her. He lifted the rifle and machine-gunned the trees, trying to wipe out the birds. Many fluttered into the sky, but the song had spread, and the woods were alive with it. Lucy Gray! Lucy Gray! Furious, he turned this way and that and finally blasted the woods in a full circle, going around and around until his bullets were spent. He collapsed on the ground, dizzy and nauseous as the woods exploded, every bird of every kind screaming its head off, while the mockingjays continued their rendition of the hanging tree. Nature gone mad. Genes gone bad. Chaos. He had to get out of there. His arm had begun to swell. He had to get back to the base. Forcing himself to his feet, he tramped back to the lake. Everything in the house had remained as he had left it. At least he'd prevented her from getting back. Using a pair of his socks as gloves, he wiped off the murder weapon, crammed all the weapons back in the burlap bag, hoisted it over his shoulder, and ran to the lake. Judging it heavy enough to sink without being weighted down with rocks, he plunged into the lake and towed it out into deeper water. He submerged the bag and watched it spiral slowly down into the gloom. An alarming tingling enveloped his arm. A clumsy dog paddle carried him back to shore, and he staggered back to the house. What of the supplies? Should he drown those as well? No point. Either she was dead and the covey would find them, or she was alive and she would hopefully use them to escape. He threw the fish into the fire to burn and left, closing the door tightly behind him. The rain began again, a real downpour. He expected it would wash away any trace of his visit. The guns were gone. The supplies were Lucy Gray's. The only thing that remained were his footprints, and those were melting before his eyes. The clouds seemed to be infiltrating his brain. He struggled to think. Get back. You must get back to base. But where was it? He pulled his father's compass from his pocket, amazed it still worked after the dunking in the lake. Crassus Snow was still out there somewhere, still protecting him. Coriolanus clung to the compass, a lifeline in the storm as he headed south. He stumbled through the woods, terrified and alone, but feeling his father's presence beside him. Crassus might not have thought much of him, but he'd have wanted his legacy to live on, and perhaps Coriolanus had redeemed himself somewhat today. None of it would matter if the venom killed him. He stopped to vomit, wishing he'd brought along the jug of water. He vaguely realized that his DNA would be on that, too, but who cared? The jug was not a murder weapon. It didn't matter. He was safe. If the covey found Lucy Gray's body, they wouldn't report it. They wouldn't want the attention it brought. It might connect them to the rebels or reveal their hideout. If there was a body. He could not even confirm he'd hit her. Coriolanus made it back. Not to the hanging tree, exactly, but to District 12. Wandering out of a stretch of trees into a clump of miners' hovels and somehow finding the road. The ground shook with thunder and lightning slashed the sky as he reached the town square. He saw no one as he made it to the base and climbed back through the fence. He went straight to the clinic, claiming he'd stopped to tie his shoe on his way to the gym when a snake had appeared out of nowhere to bite him. The doctor nodded.
The rain brings them out.
Does it? Coriolanus thought his story would have been challenged, or at least met with skepticism. The doctor did not seem suspicious.
Did you get a look at it?
Not really. It was raining, and it moved fast, he answered.
Am I going to die? Hardly, the doctor chuckled. It wasn't even venomous. See the teeth marks? No fangs. Going to be sore for a few days, though.
Are you sure? I threw up, and I couldn't think straight, he said.
Well, panic can do that.
She cleaned the wound.
Probably leave a scar.
Good, thought Coriolanus. It will remind me to be more careful. She gave him several shots and a bottle of pills.
Come by tomorrow and we'll check it again.
Tomorrow I'm being reassigned to District 2, replied Coriolanus.
Visit the clinic there then, she said. Good luck, soldier.
Coriolanus went back to his room, shocked to find it was only mid-afternoon. Between the booze and the rain, his bunkmates had never even risen. He went to the bathroom and emptied his pockets. The lake water had reduced his mother's rose-scented powder to a nasty paste, and he threw the whole thing in the trash. The photos stuck together and shredded when he tried to separate them, so they went the way of the powder. Only the compass had survived the outing. He peeled off his clothes and scrubbed off the last bits of the lake. When he dressed, he took down his duffel and began to pack, returning the compass to his box of personal items and stowing it deep in the bag. On reflection, he opened Sejanus's locker and took his box as well. When he got to District 2, he'd mail it to the plinths with a note of condolence. That would be appropriate as Sejanus's best friend, and who knew? Maybe the cookies would keep coming. The following morning, after a tearful goodbye from his bunkmates, he boarded the hovercraft for District 2. Things improved immediately. The plush seat, the attendant, the beverage selection. Not luxurious by any means, but a far cry from the recruit train. Comforted by comfort, he leaned his temple against the window, hoping to get in a nap. All night, while the rain had drummed on the barracks roof, he'd wondered where Lucy Gray was. Dead in the rain? Curled up by the fire in the lake house? If she'd survived, surely she'd abandoned the idea of returning to District 12. He dozed off with the melody to the hanging tree humming in his brain. and awoke hours later as the hovercraft touched down. "Welcome to the capital," the attendant said. Coriolanus's eyes popped open. "What? No, did I miss my stop? I have to report to District 2. This craft goes on to 2, but we have orders to drop you here," said the attendant, checking a list. "I'm afraid you need to disembark. We have a schedule to keep." He found himself on the tarmac of a small, unfamiliar airport. A peacekeeper's truck pulled up, and he was ordered into the back. As he rattled along, unable to get any information from the driver, dread seeped into him. There had been a mistake. Or had there? What if they had somehow linked him to the murders? Maybe Lucy Gray had returned and accused him, and they needed to question him. Would they drag the lake for the weapons? His heart gave a little jump as they turned onto Scholars Road and drove past the academy, quiet and still on a summer afternoon. There was the park where they'd sometimes hung out after school, and the bakery with those cupcakes he loved. At least he'd been granted one more glimpse of his hometown. Nostalgia faded as the truck made a sharp turn, and he realized they were heading up the drive to the Citadel. Inside, the guards waved him right through to the elevator. "She's expecting you in the lab." He held on to the thin hope that she meant Dr. K, not Dr. Gall, but his old nemesis waved to him from across the lab as he stepped off the elevator. Why was he here? Was he going to end up in one of her cages? As he crossed to her, he saw her drop a live baby mouse into a tank of golden snakes. "So, the victor returns. Here, hold these." Dr. Gall pushed a metal bowl filled with squirming pink rodents into his hands. Coriolanus suppressed a gag. "Hello, Dr. Gall."
"I got your letter," she said. "And your jabberjay. Too bad about young Plinth. Although, is it really? Anyway, I was pleased to see you were continuing your studies in 12, developing your worldview."
He felt himself pulled right back into the old tutorial with her as if nothing had happened. "Yes, it was eye-opening. I thought about all the things we discussed. Chaos, control, the contract, the 3 C's.
Did you think about the Hunger Games?" she asked. "The day we met, Casca asked you what their purpose was, and you gave the stock answer, to punish the districts. Would you change that now?"
Coriolanus remembered the conversation he'd had with Sejanus as they'd unpacked his duffel. "I'd elaborate on it. They're not just to punish the districts, they're part of the eternal war. Each one is its own battle. One we can hold in the palm of our hand instead of waging a real war that could get out of our control."
"Hmm."
She swung a mouse away from a gaping mouth.
"You there. Don't be greedy.
And they're a reminder of what we did to each other, what we have the potential to do again because of who we are," he continued.
"And who are we, did you determine?" she asked.
"Creatures who need the capital to survive." He couldn't help getting in a dig. "It's all pointless, though, you know. The Hunger Games. No one in 12 even watches it. Except for the Reaping. We didn't even have a working television on base."
"While that could be a problem in the future, it's a blessing this year given that I've had to erase the whole mess," said Dr. Gall. "It was a mistake getting the students mixed up in it. Especially when they started dropping like flies. Presented the capital as far too vulnerable."
"You erased it?" he asked.
"Every last copy gone, never to be aired again," she grinned. "I've a master in the vault, of course, but that's just for my own amusement."
He was glad about the erasure. It was just one more way to eliminate Lucy Gray from the world. The capital would forget her. The districts barely knew her, and District 12 had never accepted her as one of their own. In a few years, there would be a vague memory that a girl had once sung in the arena, and then that would be forgotten too. "Goodbye, Lucy Gray. We hardly knew you."
"Not a total loss. I think we'll bring Flickerman back next year. And your idea about the betting is a keeper," she said.
You need to somehow make the viewing mandatory. No one in 12 will tune into something that depressing by choice, he told her. They spend what little free time they have drinking to forget the rest of their lives.
Dr. Gall chuckled.
It seems you've learned a lot on your summer vacation, Mr. Snow.
Vacation? He said, perplexed.
Well, what were you going to do here? Laze around the capital? Combing out your curls? I thought a summer with the peacekeepers would be far more educational.
She took in the confusion on his face.
You don't think I've invested all this time in you to hand you off to those imbeciles in the districts, do you?
I don't understand. I was told, he began. She cut him off.
I've ordered you an honorable discharge, effective immediately. You're to study under me at the university.
The university? Here in the capital? He said in surprise. She dropped one last mouse into the tank.
Classes start Thursday.
Epilogue. On a brilliant October afternoon, halfway into fall term, Snow descended the marble steps of the University Science Center, modestly ignoring the turning heads. He looked gorgeous in his new suit, especially with the return of his curls, and his stint as a peacekeeper had given him a certain cachet that drove his rivals wild. He'd just finished a special honors class in military strategy with Dr. Gall, after a morning at the Citadel where he'd reported for his Game Maker internship, if you wanted to call it that. Really, the others treated him as a full-fledged member of the team. They were already working on ideas to engage the districts, as well as the capital, in next year's Hunger Games. Snow had been the one to point out that other than the life of two tributes they might not even know, the people in the districts had no stake in the games. A tribute's win needed to be a win for the whole district. They'd come up with the idea that everyone in the district would receive a parcel of food if their tribute took the crown. And to tempt a better class of tributes to possibly volunteer, Snow suggested that the victor should be given a house in a special area of town, tentatively called the Victor's Village, which would be the envy of all those people in the hovels. That and a token monetary prize should go a long way toward bringing in a decent crop of performers. His fingers stroked his butter-soft leather satchel, a back-to-school gift from the plinths. He still tripped over what to call them. Ma was easy enough, but it didn't suit to call Strabo Plinth his father, so he used Sir a lot. It wasn't as if they'd adopted him. He'd been too old at 18. Being designated an heir worked better for him anyway. He'd never give up the name Snow, not even for a munitions empire. It had all happened very naturally. His homecoming, their grief, the merging of the families. Sejanus' death had totaled the plinths. Strabo had put it simply, "My wife needs something to live for. So do I, for that matter. You've lost your parents. We've lost our son. I was thinking perhaps we could work something out." He'd bought the Snows' apartment so they didn't have to move, and the Doolittles below it for himself and Ma. There was talk of renovating, of building a spiral staircase, and perhaps a private elevator to connect the two, but there was no rush. Ma already came by daily to help with the grandmam, who'd resigned herself to having a new maid, and she and Tigress got on swimmingly. The plinths paid for everything now, the taxes on the apartment, his tuition, the cook. They gave him a generous allowance as well. This was helpful because, although he'd intercepted and pocketed the envelope of money he'd sent Tigress from District 12, university life was expensive when done right. Strabo never questioned his expenditures or nitpicked over a few new additions to his wardrobe, and he seemed pleased when Snow asked for advice. They were surprisingly compatible. At times he almost forgot old Plinth was district. Almost. Tonight would have been Sejanus' 19th birthday, and they were gathering for a quiet dinner to remember him. Snow had invited Festus and Lysistrata to join the party, as they'd liked Sejanus better than most of his classmates,
and could be counted on to say nice things. He planned to present the plinths with the box from Sejanus's locker, but first he had one more thing to do. The fresh air on the walk to the academy left his mind razor sharp. He hadn't bothered to make an appointment, preferring to drop in unexpectedly. The students had been let out an hour ago, and his footsteps rang in the hallways. Dean Highbottom's secretary's desk was empty, so he crossed to the dean's office and tapped on the door. Dean Highbottom bid him enter. Between the weight loss and the tremor, he looked worse than ever, slumped over his desk.
"Well, to what do I owe this honor?" he asked.
"I was hoping to recover my mother's compact, since you should have no further need of it," Snow replied. Dean Highbottom reached into a drawer and slapped the compact on the desk.
"Is that all?"
"No." He removed Sejanus's box from his satchel. "I'm returning Sejanus's personal effects to his parents tonight. I'm not sure what to do with this." He emptied the contents onto the desk and picked up the framed diploma. "I didn't think you'd want it floating around out there. An academy diploma, awarded to a traitor."
"You're very conscientious," said Dean Highbottom.
"That's my peacekeeper training." Snow loosened the back of the frame and slipped out the diploma. Then, as if on impulse, he replaced it with a photo of the Plinth family. "I think his parents will prefer this anyway." They both stared at the remains of Sejanus's life. Then he swept the three medicine bottles into Dean Highbottom's trash can. "The fewer bad memories, the better." Dean Highbottom eyed him.
"So, you grew a heart in the districts?"
"Not in the districts. In the Hunger Games," Snow corrected him. "I have you to thank for that. After all, you're responsible for them."
"Oh, I think half the credit for that goes to your father," said the dean.
Snow frowned. "How do you mean?" "I thought the Hunger Games were your idea, something you came up with at the university."
"For Dr. Gall's class, which I was failing, since my loathing of her made participation impossible. We paired off for the final project, so I was with my best friend. Crassus, of course. The assignment was to create a punishment for one's enemies so extreme that they would never be allowed to forget how they had wronged you. It was like a puzzle, which I excel at. And like all good creations, absurdly simple at its core. The Hunger Games. The evilest impulse, cleverly packaged into a sporting event, an entertainment. I was drunk, and your father got me drunker still, playing on my vanity as I fleshed the thing out, assuring me it was just a private joke. The next morning I awoke, horrified by what I'd made, meaning to rip it to shreds, but it was too late. Without my permission, your father had given it to Dr. Gall. He wanted the grade, you see. I never forgave him."
"He's dead," said Snow. "But she isn't," Dean Highbottom shot back. "It was never meant to be anything more than theoretical, and who but the vilest monster would stage it? After the war, she pulled my proposal out, and me with it, introducing me to Pan M as the architect of the Hunger Games. That night I tried morphling for the first time. I thought the thing would die out, it was so ghastly. It didn't. Dr. Gall took it and ran, and she has dragged me along with it for the last 10 years.
"It certainly supports her view of humanity," said Snow, "especially using the children."
"And why is that?" asked Dean Highbottom.
"Because we credit them with innocence. And even if the most innocent among us turned to killers in the Hunger Games, what does that say?"
"That our essential nature is violent," Snow explained.
"Self-destructive," Dean Highbottom murmured.
Snow remembered Pluribus's account of his father's falling out with Dean Highbottom and quoted the letter, "Like moths to a flame." The dean's eyes narrowed, but Snow only smiled and said, "But of course you're testing me. You know her far better than I do."
"I'm not so sure."
Dean Highbottom traced the silver rose on the compact with a finger.
So what did she say when you told her you were leaving?
Dr. Gall? Snow asked.
Your little songbird, the dean said. When you left 12, was she sad to see you go?
I expect it made us both a little sad.
Snow pocketed the compact and gathered Sejanus's things.
I'd better go. We have a new living room set being delivered, and I promised my cousin I'd be there to oversee the movers.
Off you go, then, said Dean Highbottom. Back to the penthouse. Snow did not care to talk about Lucy Gray with anyone, particularly not Dean Highbottom. Smiley had sent him a letter at the plinth's old address, mentioning her disappearance. Everybody thought the mayor had killed her, but they couldn't prove it. As to the covey, a new commander had replaced Hoth, and his first move had been to outlaw shows at the Hob, because music caused trouble. Yes, thought Snow. It certainly does. Lucy Gray's fate was a mystery then, just like the little girl who shared her name in that maddening song. Was she alive? Dead? A ghost who haunted the wilderness? Perhaps no one would ever really know. No matter. Snow had been the ruination of them both. Poor Lucy Gray. Poor ghost girl singing away with her birds.
Are you? Are you? Coming to the tree? Where I told you to run so we'd both be free?
She could fly around District 12 all she liked, but she and her mockingjays could never harm him again. Sometimes he would remember a moment of sweetness and almost wish things had ended differently. But it would never have worked out between them, even if he'd stayed. They were simply too different. And he didn't like love, the way it had made him feel stupid and vulnerable. If he ever married, he'd choose someone incapable of swaying his heart. Someone he hated, even, so they could never manipulate him the way Lucy Gray had. Never make him feel jealous or weak. Livia Cardew would be perfect. He imagined the two of them, the president and his first lady, presiding over the Hunger Games a few years from now. He'd continue the games, of course, when he ruled Pan Em. People would call him a tyrant, iron-fisted and cruel, but at least he would ensure survival for survival's sake, giving them a chance to evolve. What else could humanity hope for? Really, it should thank him. He passed Pluribus's nightclub and allowed himself a small smile. A person could get rat poison at any number of places, but he'd surreptitiously scooped up a pinch of it from the back alley last week and taken it home. It had been tricky getting it into the morphling bottle, especially using gloves, but eventually he'd squeezed what he'd judged to be a sufficient dose through the opening. He'd taken the precaution of making sure the bottle was wiped clean. There was nothing to make Dean Highbottom suspicious of it when he pulled it from the trash and slipped it into his pocket. Nothing when he unscrewed the dropper and dripped the morphling onto his tongue. Although he couldn't help hoping that as the dean drew his final breath, he'd realize what so many others had realized when they'd challenged him. What all of Pan Em would know one day. What was inevitable. Snow lands on top. The end. This is Santino Fontana. We hope that you have enjoyed this production of The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, a Hunger Games novel by Suzanne Collins. This program was produced and directed by Scott Sherritt. Executive producer, Paul R. Gagne. Recorded at CDM Studios in New York City by Kathleen Conti. Original music by David Mansfield. Post-production by Steve Sayarto. Print edition published by Scholastic Press, a division of Scholastic Inc. Text copyright 2020 by Suzanne Collins. Production copyright 2020 by Scholastic Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.